All right. We're going to be in chapter 17, and really these last five chapters of the book of Judges, Israel hits rock bottom, and they're just spinning out of control, and it's a tragedy. And if you've been with us for the series, you will have seen the slow decline of a nation, a tragic decline of a nation. In these chapters we've got tonight, we've got idolatry, brutality, civil war, self-destruction. And so we've got to make sure, as we've been saying each week, your approach to these chapters is really important. If you are the kind of person that comes to the scriptures with a really simplistic approach, which is not wrong altogether, but if you have a really simplistic approach, for example, the Bible is a roadmap. I open it up, I read it, it tells me how to live. There's truth in that. The Bible absolutely does tell us how to live, but you're going to sometimes, if that's the simplistic approach you have and you come simply with that understanding, you're going to open up to chunks of scripture like this and you're going to get knocked around. You're going to get yourself in trouble, or you're going to end up avoiding whole chunks of the Bible because you're just not sure what to do with them, because it doesn't instruct you how to live. There's just horrific things described and no commentary about whether it's right or wrong. So we've got to make sure we approach this stuff properly and ask, really, how am I meant to read this? Because what we're looking at is raw history. That's what it is. The raw history of how God's people go. And I tell you what, when I read things like this, it's clear in my mind that the Bible was not written by someone in God's people trying to make God's people look good. You know, it wasn't just put together by someone, forging it to make us look good in any way. Because God's people come off looking terribly most of the time in Scripture, and this is one of those examples. It's raw history. There's virtually no commentary in this section, and Israel are having a terrible time. They're abandoning their God, and they're suffering the consequences of it. It's meant to be a glorious time for them. It's meant to be that moment in history where God's people come into the promised land and live under God's rule in God's special place and live long and enjoy life and are a blessing to all the nations around them. It's meant to be the moment of moments, the moment of glory. But instead, they just spiral downwards and end up in deep confusion and ignorance of who their God is, and it leads to apostasy, and it leads to chaos, and then depravity. The pattern that we've been acknowledging all the way through the book of Judges is not even here in these final chapters. Now, the pattern I'm talking about, the four-step pattern, where it starts off with Israel did evil in the eyes of the Lord, God hands them over to be judged, they cry out in their misery, and God raises up a deliverer, a judge. There's a four-step pattern that we've seen all the way through. You get to these final chapters, the pattern's not even there, which says something, doesn't it? It's as if these aren't even really God's people anymore. It's as if God is not even relating to them as though they are his people. So far have they drifted from him. Chapter 17 and chapter 18, they're making their own gods. Chapters 19, 20, 21, they're destroying their own people. This is just raw history recorded for us. What do we do with it? Here's what we're going to attempt to do with it tonight. We're going to look and we're going to see the condition of the human heart and how rebellious it is. And then we're going to do our best to recognize that same condition in ourselves and be warned that we wouldn't make the same mistakes again. We need to hear and receive the warning of history and by grace learn from history rather than repeat the same mistakes of our own people in the past. Let's tune in, chapter 17, the first few verses. The beginning of 17 focuses in on a particular family and a particular man named Micah. And it focuses in on him almost like as a profile of your average family unit in Israel. Here's how they're going. Here's how a man's going. Chapter 18 and 19 kind of look more broadly at different tribes, and then the rest of your chapters kind of look at the nation as a whole. Starts small, broadens out. But we zoom in here and we look at a man named Micah and his mum, and we see the devastation that originates from false worship. Verse 1, now a man named Micah from the hill country of Ephraim said to his mother, I'll just pause there. from the hill country of Ephraim, probably a reference to the fact that they were pretty well off. So you've got what you might want to be able to call a rich man living in the hill country. He says to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and about which I have heard you utter a curse, I have that silver with me. I took it." Then his mother said, "The Lord bless you, my son." So what you've got here is a rich man stealing from his mum. A shonky bloke nicking money for his mum. He's not like a 7-year-old kid taking a 10-cent coin out of her purse. He's a full-grown man stealing serious wads of money from his mum. That's shonky, okay? Israel were called to honour their father and mother, care for their... This guy should have been caring for his mum, not nicking her money. But he does it. He nicks her money, and then he comes and he owns up to it. But why has he owned up to it? What's his motive? It doesn't appear to be very honourable at all. He says... He mentions a curse that his mum has uttered. And I think it's the curse that's motivating him to come back with the money. So it's not very honourable at all. He's really just trying to escape the curse of his mother. He doesn't want the curse that she's put out there, which probably went something like this. You know, a curse be on the one who stole my money, and she utters it out there. And he's thinking, oh no, I don't want a curse on me. So he comes and he admits to it to try and get rid of the curse off his head. So you got a rich man stealing from his mum with dodgy motives, just looking after himself. And you've got a mother who I want to suggest is kind of a flaky, superstitious kind of woman. She's putting curses out there on whoever nicked her money. And then she quickly flips her curse to a blessing when her dodgy son comes and admits that he's taken the money. Can you see what she does immediately there? She says, "The Lord bless you, my son." So she's flipped the curse into a blessing. She's quickly covered up her own son's sin. He's hardly a noble man. And then she decides, because this is so wonderful, that she would therefore dedicate and solemnly consecrate the money, the silver, to the Lord. Which sounds like a God-honoring thing to do, until you look at how she does it. How does she attempt to honor God with this wonderful reconciled situation? Well, let's read. "When he returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, she said, 'I solemnly consecrate my silver to the Lord.'" Fantastic. But look how she does it. "For my son to make an image overladen with silver, I will give it back to you." What's going on here? And then verse 4 just explains that that happens. "So after he returned the silver to his mother, she took 200 shekels of the silver and gave it to the silversmith, who used them to make an idol, and it was put in Micah's house." So can you pick up what she's doing here? She's thinking, this is fantastic. I need to honour God here. I need to make an offering to God. So with this silver, to honour God, and I want to make a solemn, I want to solemnly consecrate this silver, she says, gives it to him and says, "Make an idol out of it. Go and carve an idol and overlay it with all the silver, and we'll honour God that way." Now, if you're new to these kind of things, it's worth saying, you don't have to look far into the law of God before you discover that these are just bad ideas, okay? God's first command, have no other gods apart from me. His second command, no graven images. Don't try and make an image of me. Don't do it. You won't be able to do anything, put together anything with your own hands that is in any kind of likeness that is honourable for me. So don't do it. Don't ever make an image of me. They're the first two commandments. And she's breaking them both immediately. I can't help but to think, what on earth is she thinking? Why is she thinking that this is honourable to God? But it gets worse. You discover that this isn't the first time it's happened. Because she gives the instruction that he would make the idol, and then it gets put in Micah's house. And then verse 5, look what's going on in Micah's house. "So after he returned..." Now this man Micah had a shrine, and he had an ephod and some household gods, and he installed one of his own sons as priests. Okay, so this guy Micah has got a whole house full of gods. He's built a shrine in his own house, and he's got hundreds of household gods. He's got an ephod, and he's kind of picked one of his own kids and said, "How about you be the priest?" Sounds like a great idea. This should really honour God. Let's set up a shrine with pagan idols in our house, and God's going to love it. Welcome to Israel. This is God's people. A little profile of what's going on, probably everywhere in God's people. Now, I'm left thinking this. How on earth does a person who would conceive of themselves as being a follower of God, Yahweh, find themselves in a place where they think that living like this is honoring to God? You know, how does it happen? How does this kind of stuff happen? It's so messed up. The answer is in verse 6. We just need to read on. Verse 6. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. And we get this little phrase, in those days Israel had no king, repeated right throughout these last few chapters. It's the verse that's going to explain why everything's gone to seed for Israel. You see it at the beginning of chapter 18. In those days, Israel had no king. Doesn't give us the rest because you know what the rest means. Beginning of chapter 19, in those days, Israel had no king. And you see it right there at the end of chapter 21 to wrap off the whole book. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. You could call this the no king formula, which pops up through the last chunk of these chapters. What does it mean? Well, to explain the issues in Israel by saying, oh, it's because Israel had no king, assumes this, doesn't it? That if there was a king in Israel, that he would have, his presence would have put an end to this kind of nonsense, this kind of false worship, this kind of illegitimate worship. Which says what? It says that we're looking for a particular kind of king here, aren't we? For the author to say it's because Israel had no king, he's talking about a particular kind of king, not just a monarchy. He's talking about a good and godly king. The kind of king that would lead God's people to live under God as their Lord. That's the kind of king we're talking about here. The kind of king that would call all the people to sit under the covenant of Yahweh and obey his standards and live according to his law. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine the leader of a country with that kind of integrity, leading people to sit under God? Imagine that in our own country. After a week like we've just been through. I won't add any political comments. The concept here is, when it says Israel had no king, it's not simply saying, just get an earthly man in place and it'll all be good. No, no, no. It's to do with helping the people sit under God. So to say Israel had no king is to basically say Israel had moved themselves out from underneath the authority of Yahweh. They'd run away from submitting to God. And that's the problem. Because when you move out from underneath the authority of God, something else will become the authority in your life. And this formula here tells you what it most likely will be. If you are not sitting under the authority of God, you will sit under the authority of self. Self, you'll do what's right in your own eyes. Everyone did as they saw fit. That's what's going to happen. That's what happened then. That's what happens for us. You move out from underneath God and you effectively become God. And when it says everyone did as they saw fit, it means everyone lived as a lord unto themselves. Everyone just does what's right in their own eyes. Everyone makes up for themselves what's right and good. And so I think to honor God, I should carve an idol and overlay it with silver. That sounds like a good idea. That feels right to me. So I'm going to do it. And you've had a shocker. The reference point is no longer God. The authority is no longer God. The reference point is self. I decide. And this is the very key dynamic that has caused God's people to spiral out of control. You move out from underneath the authority of God and you slowly, it happens slowly, over hundreds of years here, you drift away towards moral failure. You drift away towards self-destruction. That's the pattern that we're meant to see. Now, when we read here about Micah and their idolatry, but they're thinking they're honouring God, if we were the original hearers of this writing, we would be scratching our heads and saying this, where are the Levites? That's what we'd be thinking. Anyone out there thinking that? Where are the Levites? With this kind of false worship going on, where on earth are the Levites? Now, we would be thinking that because it's the Levites who were the ones who were set aside as a tribe to help the whole nation worship God properly, worship God truly. So it's the Levites who ought to be cracking down on this kind of false worship and stepping in to help, which is why I think the story goes on to talk about a Levite. And what's this Levite up to? He's just wandering around, clueless. To kind of understand the tragedy of what's happening here, and we'll just read it in a minute, but to understand it, you do need to get a bit of background. You do need to know something about the tribe of the Levites. So let me just say really briefly, and you can pick up the detail on this in Deuteronomy 18. The Levites were the tribe of Israel, one of the 12 tribes, set aside for a very particular function in the whole nation. They're set aside to be the priests. They're set aside to be the ones who serve in the house of God, set up in each of the different 12 tribes. They're the ones who are not to be paid a wage. They're not to be actually given it. They don't get an allotment of land like all the other tribes. They are to be provided for as offerings come in for God in the house of God. That's how they are to survive, to eat of the offerings that come in. In other words, their survival is dependent on how well Israel worships and makes offerings, which is to be an indicator of how the whole nation is going. And what we got here is the whole nation in false worship. And so what are the Levites doing? Well, what you might expect them to be doing. They're wandering around looking for provision. And this guy hasn't got a clue. He's not kind of got his eyes caught in at all. But let me just read quickly from verse 7. A young Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, who had been living within the clans of Judah, left that town in search of somewhere to stay. On his way, he came to Micah's house in the hill country of Ephraim. Michael asked him, "Where are you from?" He says, "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm looking for a place to stay." A wandering priest. Dodgy. Then Micah said to him, "Live with me, be my father and my priest. I'll give you 10 shekels of silver a year, your clothes and your food." So the Levite agreed to live with him, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. Then Micah installed the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in his house. And Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since this Levite has become my priest." It's just hard to know what to point out first. Just everything's dodgy. Everything's wrong. Number one, this Levite's just running around thinking that he can offer out his services for hire. Later on in the next chapter, he actually leaves Micah and goes with a better offer. So he's out there just looking for employment rather than actually being provided for where he should be. And the biggest problem with it is that he seems to be happy to work in a private shrine full of household gods and just serve there. If this guy was a real Levite, he ought to have walked into Micah's house and gone, "What are you thinking, mate? Get rid of this shrine. Get rid of those idols. Burn the lot of them. I'm stepping out of this house. You've got to fix this up." But he just comes in, starts serving. It's all good. No idea. Meant to be a priest. These are the ones who are meant to be helping Israel to worship God properly, and they are clueless, which just tells you how bad the state of Israel was. That even their Levites, even their priests, were clueless as to what proper worship was meant to be. He later gives all kinds of dodgy words from the Lord. He's got no idea. Chapter 18 now moves into kind of a different realm. And I'm going to give an overview of 18 and 19 and 20 rather than going through the details. But here's what we're meant to see. Here's the pattern. And it begins with that same formula again, chapter 18, verse 1. In those days, Israel had no king. And here's the pattern we're meant to see now. False worship leads to moral decay. And moral decay leads to self-destruction. Because here in chapter 18, you see the moral decay. You see a whole tribe called the Danites just operating in a horrendous way. A whole tribe here is portrayed to be cowardly perpetrators of injustice. In verse 1, it doesn't sound too bad. Look, in those days, Israel had no king. In those days, the tribe of the Danites were seeking a place of their own where they might settle because they had not yet come into inheritance among the tribes of Israel. You pause there again, you think, well, that's okay, isn't it? You've got a tribe wandering around looking for somewhere to settle. What's wrong with that? Again, You need the background of what's happened here in history to understand how bad that is and how bad it is what they go on to do. The Danites, like every other tribe in Israel, were given an allotment. Pick it up in the beginning, chapter 1 in Judges. God ordains a parcel of land for every one of the tribes. They're meant to go in there, conquer the place, and in God's strength, drive out the inhabitants. That was the command given to every tribe. But chapter 1, you just see every tribe fails to do it. And chapter 2 tells you it wasn't just simply that it was hard to do, it was their own disobedience, that they didn't actually go into their allotted piece of land. So what you've got here really is the Danites who refused to go in and conquer the land, who refused to obey God and trust God. Instead, they fear the people rather than fearing God, and they fail to conquer their allotted land. And chapter 18 describes what they therefore do. They go wandering, looking for another parcel of land, and they actually end up coming across a small, peaceful group of people in a defenseless kind of territory, and they come and they cruelly crush them, and they slaughter defenseless people, the people of Laish. It's tragic. It's a tragic, cowardly piece of injustice. God's people crushing people like this in disobedience to where God told them to go. You need the background to understand how tragic it is. But on their way through, here's a little interesting thing to point out. On their way down, the Danites, on their way down to actually wipe out the people of Laish, they actually swing by Micah's house, which is kind of funny. They swing by Micah's house. So you've got Israelites swinging by an Israelite house. And check out what they do. They decide on their way through to kind of wipe him out a little. Nicky's priest, all his household gods and the idol, take it all with them on the way. It's a great idea. So they sweep through and they take all of Micah's things, but they're completely oblivious that there's anything wrong with that. And you can pick up their heart attitude when as they sweep through and they take everything, some of the men of Micah's house go after them, and they kind of stop them and they're shouting at them. And you can see verse 23 in chapter 18. Tune in there with me. As they, that's the men of Micah's house who have kind of gone after these Danites, as they shouted after them, the Danites turned and said to Micah, "What's the matter with you that you called your men out to fight?" You see what they're doing? They're like, "What?" You know, just sweep through, nick everything, and the priest from Micah's house, take all his possessions. And then Micah, and they're like, "What? What did we do wrong?" You see what's going on for them? There's such moral decay that they can't even see their own sin. They've got the lack of awareness of their own sin. They don't get what the problem is. They're blind to their own offense. They're oblivious that they're dishonoring a people, let alone dishonoring God. They got no idea that they're acting poorly. It just seemed like a good idea to them on the way through. Just doing what's right in your own eyes. Everyone did as they saw fit. Could you move yourself out from underneath the reference point of God? You become the reference point. And if it looks like a good idea to you, you go for it. And it works out for you. This is Israel robbing Israel, turning on itself. False religion, false worship leads to moral decay. And then it goes from there to self-destruction. And you see the self-destruction in chapter 19, 20, and 21. And again, I'm just going to need to give you an overview here. You see the guilt of another tribe, the tribe of Benjamin, who are just depraved and twisted. And we see the destruction of the tribe of Benjamin. And like, without going into the details, this just unbelievable immorality and brutality and injustice going on here. The author selects a particular event to graphically illustrate how depraved Israel had become, worse than any pagan nation. God's people operating like this. I'll give you the broad brush strokes. You come across a city called Gibeah within the tribe of Benjamin, and it's a city full of perverted and immoral men, equal to Sodom. Read Genesis 19, Sodom and Gomorrah. But this is a city within Israel. That depraved, that immoral. We have an unfaithful concubine who's married to a Levite man, and she is cast out by her husband in the night into the city square to suffer a night of unspeakable terror and dies. Her husband, a cruel, wretched Levite man, lacks any kind of compassion and empathy, and from his own offense, gets her, carries her home, chops her up into pieces, and sends the pieces of her out around to every other tribe. Nothing like this happens anywhere. This is shocking the pagan nations around them. Nothing like this has been seen before. It's so horrific that all of the other tribes of Israel actually catch word of it, and they all want to come together to do something about the men in the city square who did that to the woman. Which is a right thing to do, to come and bring justice on the men who did that. But the Benjamites defend the men of that city. They come to their defense. And so in the end, Israel actually turns on the whole tribe of Benjamin and wipe them out. There's a couple of hundred men left over in the end, and there's a dilemma about what to do with a couple of hundred Benjamite men. Are we going to leave a whole tribe to be completely destroyed? The picture is just disastrous. It's terrible. It's horrific. You got false worship, which kind of sounds funny to start with, but it's super serious because it leads to such moral decay that there is incredible destruction. That's the pattern that we're meant to see here in God's people. We're meant to see how things spiral without a king. We're meant to see how things spiral when God's people step out from under the authority of their God, when they effectively make a declaration of independence from their God, and they live as a law unto themselves. No doubt it kind of looks like freedom to start with, and it feels like freedom for a little while, but it leads to stupidity and annihilation. Such a tragedy. This was meant to be the moment for God's people. True freedom for them would have been to stay happily and humbly under the authority of their Lord. Obey Him. True freedom would have been to enjoy the commands of God, the constraints of God, and enjoy life. But instead, they move away. And they suffer the consequences of moving away from their God. Now, we sit back from this, and I think the easiest thing for us to do is shake our heads and just think, you're joking, aren't you? How stupid were those Israelites? How immoral were they? And that's the easiest thing for us to do, isn't it? I tell you what I reckon we need to do. We need to understand that the very thing that lay in their hearts that caused them to want to step out from under the authority of their God is the very thing that lies in our hearts. We suffer from the very same tendency to just slowly drift, but to drift. Drift out from under the authority of our King, Jesus, and drift toward living a kind of life that we see fit. We have the same tendency to drift towards living the kind of life that seems right to us because we've got the same condition of the heart. We have the same corrupted nature. And we need to be aware of that same nature in our hearts. We actually get warned in the New Testament about the very same pattern, and it can happen to us. Romans chapter 1 tells us of the pattern. It says it starts with truth suppression. You suppress the truth. You change the truth. You twist the truth about God. You shape the truth about God according to what you want Him to be and according to what you'd like Christianity to be. But when you suppress the truth, it leads to futile thinking, stupid thinking, false worship, which leads to hardened hearts, hearts that want to run from God, and hard hearts lead to foolish living. We have the potential to go down the very same slippery slope that they did, because we have the same issue with our hearts. Problem is, every generation is usually pretty blind to its own folly. I tell you, the easiest thing for us to do is look back in history and just go, I can't believe how they could think that you could live like that and it was honouring to God. That's easy for us to do. I tell you what's hard for us to do is to examine the way we live as Christians and try to predict what generations ahead of us, hundreds of years ahead of us, might look back and see in this day and age, in this generation, what are they going to be scratching their heads and giggling at and thinking, how did they think that they were Christians, but it was honouring to God to live like that? What will people say of this generation? Can we have eyes to see our own folly? Can we see where we are tempted to develop our own false worship? We must live with eyes wide to where we are at the moment. Because if truth be told, we too, just like Micah, can fill our houses full of gods. Think with me for a minute. Be prepared to analyze your own life, your own thoughts, your own heart for a moment. Can we do that? We, like Micah, fill our houses full of gods. Our furniture, all our goods that we can fill our houses with, our entertainment systems, our leisure equipment that we accumulate and we see as very precious to us. Our houses themselves can be gods. The cars we drive can be our idols. The families we try to rear, the relationships we go after, the careers we pursue, the retirement that we long for can be our idols. An idol is something that you focus on, you sacrifice for, and you put your hope in. Anything good has the potential to become an idol for us. Anything good that becomes something ultimate has turned into an idol. We need to get good at evaluating and assessing the things around us, our tendencies, the very things that we tend to worship. Because we too, just like Micah, can fill our lives with idols. And they may not be that carved, silver-laden idol that you sit up on yourself, although these days it is pretty fashionable to have a whole stack of Buddhas around your house. You may not be able to see a Buddha sitting on your shelf, but what are the idols in your life? What are the things you tend to sacrifice and put your hope in? And when I say hope in, I mean, what is that thing that you're waiting to get, or that relationship you're waiting to have, or that situation you're waiting to get resolved, and when it does, you're thinking, that's where life is going to be, that's where I'm going to be able to take that big deep breath and go, yep, living the dream. Now, what is that? Because we put our hope in stacks of things. Are we good at analysing ourselves and spotting where we build idols? Martin Luther, the theologian, said our hearts are like idol factories. The minute you put one to death, it's just producing another one. We're built to worship. And if you're not worshiping the one true and living God with all of your heart and strength and mind, you'll be worshiping everything around you. And it'll be focused on you being served. It's worth thinking about. We are like Micah. We, like Micah, also, let me say this one, think with me on it. We, like Micah, can develop our own ways to worship God that make sense to us, but may actually very well be completely dishonoring to God. Think with me. We can have conceptions about God, a picture about God and who He is, that can be almost entirely, because that's the way we'd like to picture Him. You know what I mean? We can picture God, like you can read something in Scripture and it'll tell you something about who God is, and then it'll tell you something about what God does, and you'll go, now hang on, God can't be like that and do that. And in your head, in your heart, you're thinking, I'd prefer God to be like this. And we can come to put together our own little picture of God that makes sense to us, and we can conceive of him that way. And God's there going, that's not who I am. We can worship God in ways that make sense to us. We can come up with ways of worshiping as being part of the family of God that just are very comfortable to us. So we pursue church and groups and all the different life in a way that's just really convenient and doesn't interrupt the weekend or doesn't interrupt with other things we want to do. Worshiping God in ways that make sense to us. And I will say this, the big thing about what Micah did was not necessarily idolatry, it was syncretism. I'm not sure if you've heard that word before. It's even worse than idolatry. It's to worship God in pagan ways. I think it's even more offensive to God, is to actually think you can honor him by doing the very same things that the pagans do. So I want to ask the same question. Do we do the very same thing? Do we not commit syncretism, but do we participate in that kind of thing? Do we try and honor God in the very same ways that our pagan, secular society around us thinks is a good way to live, which is effectively to get Christianity and kind of shape it to look just like how everyone else is living, but just kind of with the Christian tag on it? The question we want to ask ourselves is the way that I'm living really honoring to God? Why do you think that your life at the moment, your patterns, your speech, the activities of what you do with your time and your energy, why do you think that your life is honoring to God right now? Because it may not be honoring to God like you think it is. You may have just convinced yourself of that because everyone around you seems to think it's a good way to live, and you've just Christianized the secular culture around us. Syncretism. How else do we develop our own ways to worship God? I think here's the big one for us. We hear in the scriptures that we are to live by faith, not sight. But I think our tendency is to want to worship God by sight. Meaning, we just want to worship God with things that I can see, things that I can do, things that I can feel. And so we go after all kinds of tactile things that we can be involved in that are really effectively living by sight to honor God. And he's saying, no, honor me by faith, not by sight. There's a whole bunch of things in this. People think you worship God through nature. I just see God in nature. I worship God through focusing on the miraculous because I pursue God and evidence for him in the miraculous. I can see that, feel it. Sacramentalism, where people go after religious ritual, thinking that as I do things repetitively, I'm pleasing to God and I get some kind of divine approval through these things. We too, like Micah, develop our own ways to worship God in ways that make sense to us. We must be careful. How do we avoid it? How do we avoid making the very same mistakes that Israel did? How can we see our own fake, false worship and the potential for us to go after idols? How do we spot it and run? Here's the final things I'm going to give you. Firstly, if we're going to learn anything from the book of Judges, whatever you do, don't just do what seems right to you. Whatever you do, don't just live by your gut. Whatever you do, don't just do what your heart tells you to do. That is the mantra of the community that we live in at the moment. But whatever you do, don't do that. For the one big reason of this, you must acknowledge that your heart and your mind, your thinking, your desires are corrupted. That doesn't mean your heart can't have a good desire and your mind can't have a good thought. But the last thing you want to do is assume that every desire you have and every piece of thinking and rationale that you have, the last thing you want to do is assume that that's good. If we can learn anything from history, it's to not simply live life doing life in ways that seem right to ourselves. I say we live with a healthy suspicion of our own hearts, a healthy suspicion of our own minds. And if that's the case, if I can't simply trust that my internal bearings, that my internal reference point is the true one that I can go to, I need to do what? I need an external reference point. I need to look outside of myself for authority on life. Now, I watched a show last night with Debo on the ABC. It's called The Audience. I'm not sure if any of you guys have seen that. The idea is this. Someone's smiling over there. They pick someone who's got a particular dilemma in life and they feel like they need wise counsel about how to make that decision. They've been in the dilemma for quite a while. They get an audience or a crowd of 50 people to kind of step into their life and follow them around for a whole week, asking them heaps of questions, finding out everything they can about their situation. And the idea is that at the end of a week, the crowd of 50 people, the audience, the community, would actually deliver wise advice. It's based on the concept of the wisdom of the community. Now, there's something I really like about the show. I like the fact that it acknowledges that it's an important thing to look outside of yourself for wisdom and to acknowledge it's not simply enough to just come up in your own heart with what's right. But I don't think it goes far enough, because the problem with the crowd of 50 is there are a crowd of 50 individuals who are just as corrupt as you. So effectively, you may get some wisdom from them, but in the end, it's not infallible wisdom. And actually, if you watch the shows, I disagree. They're tricky scenarios, but I disagree with some of the big kind of advices that are given at the end. I mean, if God was to step in and give his advice on the situation, it'd be very objective and very unpopular most of the time. The wisdom of the crowd is not necessarily the reference point that's going to help us. We need to go further than the crowd. We need to go all the way to God himself. We need to go to the divine reference point, and we need to acknowledge this. We are designed to live under the loving rule of a king. That's what you're designed for, to live under King Jesus. We are to work hard at hearing his word and obeying it. We are to sit happily and humbly and continually under the sound of his voice. He is the external reference point by which life is to be lived. His call. Friends, we need a bearing outside of ourselves. We need a marker on the horizon that we look to and we don't take our eyes off it and we aim for it. If you've ever seen people do long distance swimming in the ocean, one thing that's really important is that they have a marker on the horizon that they continually lift their head and look to. Because if you keep your head down and you keep swimming and you're not in a pool with a line right along the bottom of the pool, you are going to, and it's only going to happen slowly, but you're going to drift off course over time and just do massive circles of the ocean and not get anywhere. In fact, if you go down to Terrigal any morning of the week, any of the beaches on the coast, you see those crazy nutcases with their speedos and their hats. Some of you guys out there going for their swims at the crack of dawn. No matter what the weather. But you watch what they do. They don't just get out and say, "Let's swim, woo," and just go. No. They go, "Right, we're going to hit that buoy, and then we're going to hit that buoy, or buoy, whatever you want to call them. And then we're going to go around that one, and then we're going to come back along." And they swim together, and they keep looking, and they're going for that buoy, and they go around. And if you didn't do that, you just have this group of people just going like this, swimming everywhere. Living the Christian life is like long-distance ocean swimming. You've got to keep lifting your head. You need to keep looking at the external reference point, the marker on the horizon that is our God, that is the true reference point. The internal compass is faulty, people. You live by that, you're going to go in whopping, big, massive circles, and you're going to suffer the same way the Israelites suffered. It'll feel good for a season, but you'll go in circles of destruction because you'll slowly drift off course. We need that external true marker. We need a reference point beyond ourselves. We need to fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, and continually look to him. And acknowledge that true freedom is sitting under him continually. We are designed to live under him. We are designed to receive his command and his constraint and know that he's a good God who has life for us. were to sit happily and humbly and receive course correction continually. I'm going to finish by just reading a passage to you from Hebrews 3. See to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful and unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may become hardened by sin's deceitfulness. This is Scripture calling us to acknowledge a very, very important truth. Every day you wake up, sin is crouching, deceiving. Every day we need to encourage one another as long as it's called today. Every day we need to encourage one another to look to Jesus. Every day you need to go to Him in His Word. This is not something you can let slip even for a day. A healthy distrust of sin's deceitfulness in our hearts and an external marker we must go to continually. And I'll tell you the one thing that enables me to continually be able to acknowledge my sin and my brokenness and my folly and my propensity to drift off course is the fact that I have a gracious God who loves me, and He knows my sin and He knows yours, and He knows how disastrous that it is that you need to go to the cross and die to take it and deal with it so I could be offered forgiveness. We have a gracious God. Let me pray. Father, we thank You for Your word, as hard as it is to hear, as difficult as it is to consider that our hearts are the same as those Israelites, and our tendency is to drift and move ourselves out from underneath Your authority. Lord, would You help us learn from history? Would You help us receive the warning? Would You help us to worship You in spirit and in truth, come to You properly, humbly, happily, sitting under Your command, Your constraint, knowing that that is where life comes from? Lord, would You take Your glory for the work that You do in us only by Your Spirit? Amen.